huge house of cards. It is now known that almost all of what he said that day wasn't solid, that much of it was deemed doubtful, even at the time, inside the intelligence community, and that some of it was flatly false. The official, bipartisan conclusion of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's review of the pre-war handling of intelligence was, much of the information provided or cleared by the Central Intelligence Agency for inclusion in Secretary Powell's speech was overstated, misleading, or incorrect. The assertion about chemical weapons would be proven flat wrong. The assertion about the nuclear program was based heavily on the belief that Iraq was seeking aluminum tubes for a centrifuge to enrich uranium for a nuclear program. The key question was whether the tubes were of a lower quality alloy suitable for military rockets or more finely made for nuclear work. It strikes me as quite odd that these tubes are manufactured to a tolerance that far exceeds U.S. requirements for comparable rockets, Powell said. But the State Department's own intelligence office had contradicted that very assertion 2 days earlier in its critique of a draft of Powell's speech. It objected to that statement about manufacture. In fact, it stated in a memorandum, the most comparable U.S. system is a tactical rocket, the U.S. Mark 66 air-launched 70-millimeter rocket that uses the same high-grade 7075T6 aluminum and that has specifications with similar tolerances. Worst of all, the assertion about biological weapons was based largely on the statements of one defector, codenamed Curveball, whose testimony already had been discredited. There was a second source for the statements about biological efforts, and that source had been formally declared a fabricator 10 months earlier by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which was handling him, but no one had told Powell about that. Powell believed what he said. Richard Armitage, who had gone out to the CIA's headquarters in Langley, Virginia, to help prepare Powell for the speech, recalled the effort that the Secretary of State put into it. He worked for 3 days and parts of all those nights, Armitage recalled. He called me up and said, "Can you come with me tomorrow? I need your help." And I went up there and was there all day, and he went through each point in the speech, every single one, and looked at everybody in the room, and nobody dissented. Are we sure of the information? Are we sure of the sourcing? Is there anything wrong with the sourcing? And I don't know what more he could have done. George Tenet, the CIA director, was also there as Powell prepared, and kept coming in and out of the room, ordering his station chiefs to go back and check individual bits of information, Armitage recalled. George would go out of the room, "Call this country," he'd say, "call that country." They're in the room and they're nodding, "Everything's fine," Armitage recalled. What are you going to do? What is he to do? I don't know. Armitage's conclusion 2 years later was that the agency let him down big time. The speech clearly didn't turn out to hold water. Powell had done the job. His performance had the desired effect of calming doubts in two camps of notable skeptics, the U.S. military and the pundits of journalism. The Bush administration's approach to selling a war in Iraq was to say, "Trust us." And Powell was one of the nation's most trusted figures, especially among moderates and liberals. Voices presenting other dissenting views, and ones that it is now clear had a better factual basis, were drowned out by Powell's performance. In February, Mohammed El-Baradei, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, a nuclear watchdog office, reported to the United Nations, "We have found to date no evidence of ongoing prohibited nuclear or nuclear-related activities in Iraq." 3 weeks later, he returned and stated even more emphatically that Iraq's weapons capabilities had deteriorated badly since the time of the Desert Fox raid. "During the past 4 years," he told the Security Council, "at the majority of Iraqi sites, industrial capacity has deteriorated substantially due to the departure of foreign support that often was present in the late 80s, the departure of large numbers of skilled Iraqi personnel in the past decade, and the lack of consistent maintenance by Iraq of sophisticated equipment." He was all but ignored. Before heading to Capitol Hill on February 25, 2003, General Shinseki asked historians on the Army's staff to research the number of peacekeepers used in Germany and Japan after World War II and after other conflicts. The data came back from the Army's Center of Military History. In Iraq, the post-war peacekeeping force should probably number about 260,000, the researchers told him. That was the number in the back of his mind when he went to Capitol Hill and was pinned down on the issue. General Shinseki, could you give us some idea as to the magnitude of the Army's force requirement for an occupation of Iraq following a successful completion of the war? Asked Senator Carl Levin, the senior Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. In specific numbers, I would have to rely on the combatant commander's exact requirements, Shinseki replied, obeying the military protocol of deferring to the responsible commander, in this case General Franks. But I think... How about a range? Levin interrupted. I would say that what's been mobilized to this point, something on the order of several hundred thousand soldiers, are probably, you know, a figure that would be required. His reasoning, he added, was that Iraq was a large country with multiple ethnic tensions. So it takes significant ground force presence to maintain a safe and secure environment to ensure that people are fed, that water is distributed, all the normal responsibilities that go along with administering a situation like this. Shinseki didn't know it, but that exchange, virtually the only discussion of Iraq in a hearing that focused more on mundane issues of military force structures and budgets, would be the most remembered public moment of his 4 years as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. His comments were not greeted warmly by his civilian overseers at the Pentagon. Thomas White, the Army Secretary, recalled being told by Wolfowitz that Shinseki had been out of line. He was not happy that we had taken a position that was opposed to what his thinking on the subject was. Wolfowitz told senior Army officers around this time that he thought that within a few months of the invasion, the U.S. troop level in Iraq would be 34,000, recalled Riggs, the Army general then at Army headquarters. Likewise, another three-star general, still on active duty, remembers being told the plan to have the U.S. occupation force reduced to 30,000 troops by August 2003. An Army briefing a year later also noted that that number was the goal by the end of the summer of 2003. When Wolfowitz was on the Hill 2 days later, he slapped down Shinseki's estimate. There has been a good deal of comment, some of it quite outlandish, about what our post-war requirements might be in Iraq, he told the House Budget Committee. Some of the higher-end predictions that we have been hearing recently, such as the notion that it will take several hundred thousand U.S. troops to provide stability in post-Saddam Iraq, are wildly off the mark. His reasoning, he explained, was that it is hard to conceive that it would take more forces to provide stability in post-Saddam Iraq than it would to conduct the war itself and to secure the surrender of Saddam's security forces and his army. Hard to imagine. In an intellectually snide aside, he also said that one should at least pay attention to past experience. Bosnia, Wolfowitz maintained, wasn't the proper precedent to study. There has been none of the record in Iraq of ethnic militias fighting one another that produced so much bloodshed and permanent scars in Bosnia, he said. Rather, one should look to the far more benign environment of Operation Provide Comfort in northern Iraq. At any rate, Wolfowitz said, he had met with Iraqi Americans in Detroit a week earlier. Based on what he had heard about Iraq from them, he said, I am reasonably certain that they will greet us as liberators, and that will help us keep requirements down. So, he concluded, we don't know what the requirements will be, but we can say with reasonable confidence that the notion of hundreds of thousands of American troops is way off the mark. In keeping with this extraordinarily optimistic assessment, Wolfowitz also would assert that same day that oil exports likely would pay for much of Iraq's post-war reconstruction. It's got already, I believe, on the order of $15 billion to $20 billion a year in oil exports, which might finally be turned to a good use instead of building Saddam's palaces, he told the House Budget Committee. There is a lot of money there. He repeated the point a month later to another congressional committee, saying that Iraq can really finance its own reconstruction. As for an administration official who had told the Washington Post that the war and its aftermath could cost as much as $95 billion, Wolfowitz said, "I don't think he or she knows what he's talking about." By mid-2006, the cost of the war, counting the expenditures in Iraq of all parts of the federal government, would be close to triple that. The Army wasn't buying the optimism. Retired Army Major General William Nash, who had led the U.S. peacekeeping forces into Bosnia, forecast that spring that the occupation would take 200,000 troops, almost exactly the troop total in much of 2004-5, if to the 150,000 U.S. personnel there are added 20,000 private security contractors and 30,000 Allied soldiers. At the time, Pentagon officials publicly played down Shinseki's comments, claiming he had been mousetrapped into making them. But a month later, when the Army chief was again on Capitol Hill, he was asked about them again. Yes, he told the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, he stood by his estimate of the occupation force that could be necessary in post-war Iraq. It could be as high as several hundred thousand, Shinseki said. We all hope it is something less. Wolfowitz's slapdown of Shinseki echoed for months across the military, said Senator Jack Reed, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who as a young man had served in the 82nd Airborne. Not only was he honest, but he turned out to be right, Reed, a Rhode Island Democrat, noted 2 years later. He was treated very poorly. I think it's had a chilling effect. Very destructive. Corrosive. Inside the uniformed military, officers kept quiet, at least publicly. But their private unhappiness ran deep. A few weeks before the war began, one civilian deeply involved in Army affairs meditated on this sad situation. "There is so much disdain in the services right now for OSD that it has just been reduced to, fuck you, whatever you want, we don't. If OSD ordered the Navy to build another carrier, the Navy would say it wanted sail power." It was not a healthy state for a military establishment to be in on the eve of war. As war was about to begin, everything was ready except for one thing, a real war plan. The official view at the Pentagon is that solid planning was done. The idea that the U.S. government had no plan for the aftermath of war is false, Wolfowitz insisted in July 2003. It was just, he said, that every plan requires adjustment once conflict begins. But many other participants disagree, as increasingly do military historians who have examined the record. Lieutenant General Kellogg was one of the senior members of the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, overseeing systems for the command and control of forces. "I was there for all the planning, all the execution of the Iraq war plan, and then later served in Iraq. I saw it all." But what he never saw was a real plan for Phase 4. That is, what to do after toppling Saddam Hussein's regime. There was no real plan, Kellogg said. The thought was, you didn't need it. The assumption was that everything would be fine after the war, that they'd be happy they got rid of Saddam. Despite the many studies and briefings done, wrote Major Isaiah Wilson, who served as an official Army historian during the spring 2003 invasion and later as a strategic planner in Iraq, there was no Phase 4 plan for occupying Iraq after the combat phase. While various offices had produced studies, he said, in a paper later delivered at Cornell University, there was no single plan as of 1 May 2004 that described an executable approach to achieving the stated strategic end state for the war. The reason for this omission, said Army Colonel Gregory Gardner, who served on the Joint Staff and then was assigned to the Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, the U.S. Occupation Headquarters, as his last post before retiring, was that it was seen as unnecessary. "Politically, we'd made a decision that we'd turn it over to the Iraqis in June of 2003, recalled Gardner. So why have a Phase 4 plan? Eclipse 2, as the Army's plan for Phase 4 operations was codenamed, was founded on three basic assumptions, all of which ultimately would prove false. These were, according to an internal Army War College summary, 1. That there would be large numbers of Iraqi security forces willing and able to support the occupation. Or, as the War College's Strategic Studies Institute put it in PowerPointees, availability of significant numbers of Iraqi military and police who switched sides. 2. That the international community would pick up the slack from the U.S. military. That is, significant support from other nations, international organizations, and non-governmental organizations. It isn't clear what this assumption was based on, given the widespread and building opposition to the U.S.-led invasion. 3. That an Iraqi government would quickly spring into being, permitting a quick handoff to Iraqi interim administration with UN mandate. When assumptions are wrong, everything built on them is undermined. Because the Pentagon assumed that U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators and that an Iraqi government would be stood up quickly, it didn't plan seriously for less rosy scenarios. Because it so underestimated the task at hand, it didn't send a well-trained, coherent team of professionals, but rather an odd collection of youthful Republican campaign workers and other novices. Nor did it send enough people, in part because of the poor quality and sheer lack of CPA personnel. The U.S. occupation authorities would prove unable to adjust their stance quickly when assumptions proved wrong. Because of that incompetence, the CPA would be unable to provide basic services such as electricity, clean water, and security to the Iraqi population. And so, in the fall of 2003, it would begin to lose the lukewarm support it had enjoyed. Part 2. Into Iraq. Chapter 7. Winning a Battle. March through April, 2003. History will record that America's strategy for fighting terrorism was a good strategy, that the plan for Operation Iraqi Freedom was a good plan, and that the execution of that plan by our young men and women in uniform was unequaled in its excellence by anything in the annals of war, General Franks asserted in his memoir, American Soldier. It now seems more likely that history's judgment will be that the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003 was based on perhaps the worst war plan in American history. It was a campaign plan for a few battles, not a plan to prevail and secure victory. Its incompleteness helped create the conditions for the difficult occupation that followed. The invasion is of interest now, mainly for its role in creating those problems. Cobra 2, the ground component of the classified U.S. war plan, began by flatly stating the intention of the nation in going to war. The purpose of this operation is to force the collapse of the Iraqi regime and deny it the use of WMD to threaten its neighbors and U.S. interests in regions. The plan that follows that statement of intent is designed to achieve that relatively narrow goal. The end state for this operation is regime change, Cobra 2 states a few paragraphs later. But the United States wasn't invading Iraq just to knock off a regime. If the intent of operations in Iraq in 2003 was merely regime destruction, which it was not, then the short, decisive warfighting operation of March and April 2003 might in itself have constituted success, Major General Jonathan Bailey noted shortly after retiring from the British Army in 2005. In all other respects, it might have been counterproductive. Fittingly, a war justified by false premises began on false information. Combat commenced on March 19, 2003 in Iraq. It was still the evening of March 18 in Washington, D.C., with a volley of cruise missiles and bunker-penetrating bombs against Dura Farms, a group of houses sometimes used by Saddam Hussein, located in a palm grove on the western bank of the Tigris in the southern outskirts of Baghdad. After the CIA received hot intelligence indicating that Saddam was there, Tenet rushed with the information to the White House, and the decision was made to accelerate the invasion plan. At the time, it was thought the airstrike might have killed or wounded Saddam, but in fact he seems to have been nowhere in the area. The activity in the tree line that had excited the CIA that day likely was just the security guards and farmhands from Dura Farms. Sahad Hassan, a guard at the main gate, said in an interview that everyone knew war was coming and that the U.S. bombing would target Saddam's palaces, so they had moved their families and most valuable possessions into the groves nearly a mile outside the walls of the compound. "We were damn sure the presidential palaces would be bombed," he said. Richard Perle later concluded that the U.S. government had been fooled. "There is reason to believe that we were sucked into an initial attack aimed at Saddam himself by double agents planted by the regime," he would tell the House Armed Services Committee in April 2005. "This was, I believe, a successful intelligence operation by Saddam Hussein in which we were led to believe that he was in a certain location, and he wasn't there." What followed on the U.S. side was a very conventional campaign designed as an attack by one state's military on another's, Major Isaiah Wilson later concluded. It was a war focused operationally on the destruction of the Iraqi army, the state's warfighting capability, and destruction of the Hussein state apparatus, he wrote. In this sense, he added, it was effectively a continuation of the 1991 war. The ground attack began at dawn on March 21, when it was still March 20 back in Washington. The reason some accounts differ on the date. The total U.S.-led invasion force consisted of fewer than three Army divisions, plus a big Marine division and a British division. Underscoring the relatively small size of the force, there were just 247 Army tanks in the force driving into Iraq from Kuwait, and about an equal number of Bradley fighting vehicles. The entire ground invasion force amounted to about 145,000 troops, including the British contribution. That is, well under half the size of the force that General Zinni had called for in his Desert Crossing invasion plan. In March 2003, there was just one heavy Army division, the 3rd Infantry Division, plus a helicopter-rich light division, the 101st Airborne, and two infantry brigades, from the 82nd Airborne and a freestanding unit, the 173rd Airborne Brigade, plus some special operations units, for a total of about 65,000 troops. The Marine contingent added another 60,000, and the British 1st Armored Division some 20,000. They were attacking a weakened Iraqi military that was one-third the size it had been in 1991, but which still fielded about 400,000 troops and 4,000 tanks and other armored vehicles. More significantly, it would develop, the Iraqis also had in waiting tens of thousands of irregular fighters called Fedayeen. The 3rd Infantry Division, despite its name, it is a unit heavy in tanks and other armored vehicles, sprinted about 90 miles from the Kuwaiti border across the desert to An-Nasiriya, where it seized a key airfield and, even more importantly, some bridges over the Euphrates. After turning those key spans over to the Marines, the division turned left and charged northward along the western bank of the Euphrates toward Karbala. The Marines secured the southern oil fields, then moved north and began crossing the Euphrates around Nasiriya and attacking up into the land between the rivers. British armored forces, meanwhile, peeled to the right from Kuwait to besiege Basra, Iraq's second biggest city. Much smaller numbers of special operations troops swarmed into the far west, where their mission was to prevent Scud missile launches against Israel, and into the north, where they linked up with Kurdish fighters. It didn't take long for the Iraqi side to begin operating unconventionally. The first taste of what lay in store for the Americans in Iraq for the next several years came just over one day into the war, early on March 22nd, when Sergeant First Class Anthony Broadhead, a platoon sergeant in the Crazy Horse Troop of the 3rd Infantry Division's Cavalry Unit, the spearhead of the division, was looking out of a tank heading toward a bridge in As-Samawa, a town 60 miles past Nasiriya on the invasion route. He waved at a group of Iraqis. Instead of waving back, they began attacking with AK-47 rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, riding at the American tanks in pickup trucks. For the first but not the last time, well-armed paramilitary forces, indistinguishable except for their weapons from civilians, attacked, recorded the Army's official history of the invasion. Another taste of the difficult future waiting for the United States in Iraq came several days later, when four U.S. soldiers were killed in Najaf in the first suicide car bombing of the war. The expectation that Iraqi commanders in the South would surrender and even bring their forces over to the side of the Americans by the thousands proved wrong. Not one commander did so. We were absolutely convinced, in a lot of ways, that this guy was going to capitulate with all these southern forces, General Thurman, the operations director for the ground invasion, said later. We were told that by the CIA. We were told that by intel reports, in the assessment. And that isn't what happened. We had to fight our way through every town. In the following days, the long-running debate about whether there were enough troops in the invasion force, which mainly had occurred behind closed doors, burst into the open. It would continue to be argued for years. The issue was driven into public view by the Jessica Lynch debacle, in which a poorly trained and led support unit got lost in Iraq, in part because of a lack of troops to direct convoy traffic at key points. Early on the morning of March 23rd, Lynch's unit, the 507th Maintenance Company, was at the tail end of a slow-moving 600-vehicle convoy when it missed a turn and drove into Nasiriyah, where it ran into a series of ambushes. Of 33 soldiers in the lost section, 11 were killed, 9 were wounded, and 7 captured. The unit was not trained to be in the situation they were in, was not equipped to be there. No GPS, global positioning system, a satellite-guided navigation system. No radios, no training on crew-served weapons. Only one crew-served weapon in there. No night vision gear, was the harsh but accurate judgment later delivered by General Peter Shoemaker after he became Army Chief of Staff. That night brought another ugly surprise, when the 11th Attack Helicopter Regiment was hammered when it carried out an attack deep behind the front lines. Its mission was to destroy the armored vehicles and artillery pieces of the Medina Division northeast of Karbala before they reached the front. But the helicopters never really engaged the enemy unit, and instead turned back after running into a storm of rifle fire. One helicopter was lost and its two crewmen captured. Of 32 aircraft that returned to base, 31 had been hit by enemy fire. One aircraft alone had 29 bullet holes, according to the Army's history. It was a shock to Army aviators, who liked to think of their AH-64 Apaches as flying tanks. The defeat would reverberate through the Army for years. Early in 2006, the Army quietly disclosed that it had concluded that the Apache was so vulnerable to rifle fire that it would no longer have a major role in attacks deep behind enemy lines. The two setbacks combined to sharpen questions among defense experts about the wisdom of going to war with the force Rumsfeld had dictated to the military. Most notably, Army General Barry McCaffrey, commander of the 24th Infantry Division in the 1991 war, was sharply critical at the time. In my judgment, there should have been a minimum of two heavy divisions and an armored cavalry regiment on the ground. That's how our doctrine reads, said the hard-bitten soldier, who, to the irritation of the Pentagon, had become a frequent commentator on television. They chose to go into battle with a ground combat capability that was inadequate, unless their assumptions proved out. The criticism got under Myers' skin, who was in the difficult position of being a career pilot, an Air Force officer, responding to the views of men who had been senior commanders in ground combat. He responded with uncharacteristic ferocity in a Pentagon briefing. My view of those reports, and since I don't know who you're quoting, who the individuals are, is that they're bogus, began the usually bland Myers. I don't know how they get started, and I don't know how they've been perpetuated, but it's not been by responsible members of the team that put this all together. They either weren't there, or they don't know, or they're working another agenda, and I don't know what that agenda might be. He then went on to hint that such criticism was unpatriotic coming during wartime. It is not helpful to have those kind of comments come out when we've got troops in combat, because first of all, they're false, they're absolutely wrong, they bear no resemblance to the truth, and it's just harmful to our troops that are out there fighting very bravely, very courageously. One likely reason for the antagonism in Myers' comments was that there were intense discussions underway at the Pentagon of just that issue, of how many more troops to send to Iraq. That week was bad juju, recalled a planner on the joint staff who participated in a series of briefings to Rumsfeld that became a running discussion of whether all the additional troops on the deployment list were really needed. The military overwhelmingly believed that all the troops on the list should be sent. This officer recalled one briefing that came not long after the Jessica Lynch mess, in which Abba's aide, speaking in a secure video teleconference, said to Army Lieutenant General Walter Skip Sharp, the J-5, or Director of Plans and Strategy for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, "Hey, Skip, I think we're going to need the whole force package." A few weeks later, when planners at Combined Joint Task Force 7 did a formal troop-to-task analysis, they concluded that they needed a force of 250 to 300,000, almost double what they had on hand at the time. The war plans called for additional forces to be sent after the fall of Baghdad, noted Conrad Crane. But the two top civilians at the Pentagon remained skeptical. "I don't see why it would take more troops to occupy the country than to take down the regime," Wolfowitz said in one meeting, recalled the officer involved in Pentagon planning. Rumsfeld had similar reservations about whether the 1st Cavalry Division was really needed, the officer said. It and the 1st Armored Division had been in the plan as insurance, in case some of the lead forces in the invasion were hit with chemical or biological weapons, said Agoglio. With the passage of time, when it became less likely that the U.S. invasion force was going to be attacked, pressure increased from the Pentagon civilians to stop moving those two follow-on divisions. At one point, the war planner spoke up to urge that the military fly in the 2nd ACR now, at least one squadron, and the whole regiment if he can. The point he remembered making to Rumsfeld was that the invasion force needed to do a better job of protecting its lines of communication, and that the regiment would be ideal for operating independently, securing key intersections, and reconnoitering routes. Even with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment in the pipeline, senior military officials in both Washington and on the ground in Iraq worried as Baghdad was about to fall that the force lacked combat depth. Wolfowitz remained strongly opposed to sending the two heavy divisions, the 1st Armored and the 1st Cavalry. After one meeting, the senior officers involved in the discussion trudged downstairs to the offices of the Joint Staff. Casey, who at that point had been promoted to the important job of Director of the Joint Staff, looked at his two key subordinates and said, "I think we just lost the 1st Cav." Casey indicated that he thought the running argument was eroding relations with Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, and so needed to be brought to an end, another Joint Staff officer recalled. Top officers feared that if the discussions dragged on, Rumsfeld would decide that the 1st Armored Division really wasn't needed either. So they made the argument to Rumsfeld that it was essential to send it, and to keep the 1st Cav on hold, possibly for sending in midsummer. The defense secretary ultimately agreed to that hedge plan. But there was an edge of bitterness to that session. As we were walking out the door of the office, the secretary's behind his desk and he looks up and says, "God damn it, I wonder how long it's going to take for this to get into the newspaper." In all these weeks of arguments over troop deployments, the voice that he thought was missing was that of General Franks. The military could have gotten it if the combatant commander had come down on it firmly and said, "I want the whole force package." Another disquieting note was that as the U.S. military invaded Iraq, U.S. intelligence picked up indications that Ahmed Chalabi's organization was conveying information about U.S. troop movements to the government of Iran. I don't want to say what the source was, but there was some evidence that there was an operational relationship between Chalabi and Tehran, said a senior U.S. military intelligence officer. It was during the first 10 days of the war, about the same time that we saw solid evidence that Iran had a plan, operators in the south, people moving back and forth. The difference between Tommy Franks and Tehran, he said grimly, was that the Iranians had a good Phase 4 plan. Asked much later about his relations with the Iranian government, Chalabi said, not completely clearly, "I did not pass any information to Iran that compromised any national security information of the United States." Despite these tremors, Chalabi still looked like the Pentagon's choice to lead post-war Iraq. In early April, the U.S. Air Force flew a few hundred members of Chalabi's militia to southern Iraq. The vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine General Peter Pace, envisioned a major role for them. These are Iraqi citizens who want to fight for a free Iraq, who are, who will become, basically, the core of the new Iraqi army once Iraq is free, said Pace, the nation's number two military officer. They are the beginning of the Free Iraqi Army. A statement issued by the Iraqi National Congress, INC, in Chalabi's name, said that the number of fighters is expected to increase quickly. As it happened, the force actually proved ineffective and did little. The official history produced by the Army Special Operations Command blamed its stall out partly on internal divisions in the U.S. government. The U.S. Defense Department championed Chalabi and the FIF, Free Iraqi Fighters, and saw them as a transitional force to be used in lieu of the police, it reported. The State Department, on the other hand, saw the FIF as nothing more than the military arm of the INC. That assessment, while accurate, is incomplete. Another more important division, one within the military establishment, actually crippled this force. Pentagon civilians, most notably Wolfowitz and Feith, supported the training of Iraqi forces, while Central Command dragged its feet. Chalabi later maintained that Abizaid, then one of Frank's two deputies, had told him not to fly to southern Iraq. "I did it anyway, and he was very angry," he said. It isn't clear why Rumsfeld and his subordinates were unable to make Central Command more responsive to civilian control. In principle, the training of Iraqis was exactly the right course, and ultimately the one that the U.S. military would settle on as the exit strategy for Iraq. But in the spring of 2003, the U.S. military wasn't yet interested. Retired Marine Lieutenant General Michael DeLong, Franks's other deputy, called the training effort a waste of time and energy for us. He reported of Chalabi's militia, "While some of them were helpful in small battles, we received many more reports of their looting and thievery in Baghdad." The charge northward from Kuwait to the outskirts of Baghdad generally went swiftly, but was sufficiently troubled with long and vulnerable lines of supply that just 1 week into the invasion, some U.S. commanders began issuing warnings. "The enemy we're fighting is different from the one we'd wargamed against," Lieutenant General William S. Wallace, commander of 5 Corps and a candid man, told reporters. That remark briefly became hugely controversial. On top of that, a huge sandstorm and rainstorm descended on Iraq on March 24th and lasted for 3 days, grounding the invasion forces' helicopters and miring many troops. "It was like a tornado of mud," Major General David Petraeus, commander of the 101st Airborne Division, said a few weeks later. But even then, the U.S. military was able to use sophisticated radars and other sensors to peer through with devastating effect. Late one night during the tempest, a Republican Guard missile unit concealed its Frog 7 launcher vehicles deep in a palm grove in the Saba Akbar, or Seven Virgins, area in the northern suburbs of Baghdad. They were off the road, cloaked by the trees, by the darkness, and by the dirt-laden winds of the storm. Even so, they were hit by 2 enormous bombs and then by a spray of flesh-shredding cluster bomblets. Omar Khalidi, a Republican Guard captain, said that this aerial attack demoralized his men enormously. "They were hiding and thought nobody could find them," he said. "Some soldiers left their positions and ran away. When the big bombs hit their target, some of the vehicles just melted, and the effect of the cluster bombs was even greater because they covered a larger area. The only way their concealed vehicles could have been detected," Khalidi wrongly calculated, "was by betrayal, a powerfully damaging conclusion for troops under fire to reach. Most of the commanders were sure it was through spies, because it was impossible to find through satellite or aircraft. Even if you drove by it, you couldn't find it." Likewise, when Qusay Hussein ordered 3 elite Republican Guard divisions to move southwest of Baghdad to confront the American offensive, American bombers destroyed them before they could even get near the U.S. forces. This affected the morale of the troops, an Iraqi general staff officer later told the Washington Post's William Brannigan. The Iraqi will to fight was broken outside Baghdad. On April 3, the 3rd Infantry Division took Saddam International Airport on the western fringe of Baghdad. 2 days later, it launched the first of two Thunder Runs, monstrous charges of tanks and other armored vehicles, into the capital. These probes showed the U.S. Army at its best, taking tactical risks that paid off handsomely. Most notably, they led to an abandonment of the U.S. plan to cordon off the city and move in slowly. Rather, the two Thunder Runs led to the swift collapse of the regime. The opposition to these audacious forays was fierce. When the 3rd Infantry Division's 2nd Brigade, commanded by Colonel David Perkins, drove into the city for the first time just after dawn on the morning of April 5, it was slammed repeatedly with rocket-propelled grenades, RPG, and rifle fire at effectively point-blank range along nearly its entire route, according to an Army War College report. Every single vehicle in the column was hit at least once by Iraqi RPGs, and many took multiple hits. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Twitty, one of Perkins's battalion commanders, later described their first run into the city as 8 hours of continuous fighting. At one point, one unit at a key intersection appeared in danger of running out of ammunition and being overrun. The first attack consisted of an armored column built around 29 tanks that swung up a major highway, Route 8, that cut into the southwestern part of Baghdad, a mix of industrial areas and square, two-story adobe-style houses, and then veered out to catch the arrow-straight four-lane expressway to the sprawling international airport west of the city. In these battles, Franks's maxim that speed kills did indeed apply. Perkins observed that the Iraqi defenders were only prepared to fight in one direction, so a fast move through their lines tended to disorient their response. The tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles arriving at the airport at the end of the first run appeared to be in flames because the intense shooting had set fire to the backpacks and other gear that U.S. armored soldiers carry on the outside of their vehicles. The 3rd Infantry Division estimated that it killed 2,000 enemy fighters during this mission. Its official history offers no figure for the number of civilians killed, but the Iraqis said there were many. "I was emotionally spent," said Lieutenant Colonel Eric Schwartz, who commanded an armored battalion in the first attack. "One of my tank commanders had been killed. I had a soldier shot in the eye, shot in the forehead, shot in the shoulder, shot in the back, shot in the face. I just needed time for myself. One of the other battalion commanders from 1st Brigade came over and asked me, 'Are you okay?' And I said, 'I don't know.'" On April 7, the second foray cut through to Saddam's palace complex in the center of Baghdad, on the left bank of the Tigris, and decided to stay. The American military believed it had taken Baghdad. To understand that mistaken conclusion, it is necessary to step back and examine General Tommy Franks, the senior U.S. commander in the war, and particularly his misunderstanding of strategy. That is a grand-sounding word, and it is frequently misused by laymen as a synonym for tactics. In fact, strategy has a very different and quite simple meaning that flows from just one short set of questions. Who are we? And what are we ultimately trying to do here? How will we do it? And what resources and means will we employ in doing it? The four answers give rise to one's strategy. Ideally, one's tactics will then follow from them. That is, this is who we are. This is the outcome we wish to achieve. This is how we aim to do it. And this is what we will use to do it. But addressing the questions well can be surprisingly difficult. And if the answers are incorrect or incomplete, or the goals listed not reachable, then the consequences can be disastrous. Why would the United States invade Iraq without a genuine strategy in hand? Part of the answer lies in the personality and character of General Franks. The inside word in the U.S. military long had been that Franks didn't think strategically. For example, when the general held an off-the-record session with officers studying at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island in the spring of 2002, not long after the biggest battle of the Afghan War, Operation Anaconda, one student posed the classic Clausewitzian question, "What is the nature of the war you are fighting in Afghanistan?" "That's a great question for historians," Franks sidestepped, recalled another officer who was there. "Let me tell you what we are doing. Franks proceeded to discuss how U.S. troops cleared cave complexes in Afghanistan. It was the most tactical answer possible, quite remote from what the officer had asked. It would have been a fine reply for a sergeant to offer, but not a senior general. He really was comfortable at the tactical level, this officer recalled with dismay. Franks's plan for making war in Iraq was built around U.S. technological and mechanical advantages. Speed kills, the general insisted to his subordinates as they wrote and rewrote the massive plan. It sounded good, like a tough-minded way of slicing through all the bureaucratic nonsense. But it reflected the larger misconception of the war at hand. Speed didn't kill the enemy. It bypassed him. It won the campaign, but it didn't win the war, because the war plan was built on the mistaken strategic goal of capturing Baghdad, and it confused removing Iraq's regime with the far more difficult task of changing the entire country. The result was that the U.S. effort resembled a banana republic coup d'etat more than a full-scale war plan that reflected the ambition of a great power to alter the politics of a crucial region of the world. So, where Frank's plan should have been grounded in a wide-ranging strategy, it instead was built on a series of operational assumptions, many of which proved incorrect. Probably the single most startling passage in his memoir is his description of 9 slices representing Iraqi centers of gravity in Iraq, which is an abuse of Clausewitz's definition of the key target in war. He relates how in December 2001 he sketched a working matrix of targets in Iraq, leadership, internal security, and so on, along with the tools he intended to use against them, operational fires, operational maneuver, SOF operations, and so on. This was, as the names of those tools indicate, a relentlessly operational approach, a collection of tactics, nothing more, nothing less, and certainly not a strategic formulation for what he wanted Iraq ultimately to look like and how he planned to achieve that end. When he showed this chart to General Renouart, he said proudly, "This is what you call your basic grand strategy." It was an amazingly wrong assertion. The chart had little of strategy in it. In the way Franks used the term, there were so many centers that they added up to nothing. No one real center of gravity. In describing these numerous centers of gravity, Franks inadvertently underscored his lack of strategic understanding. There is no doubt that Franks executed the mission given him. As a military professional, he should have done more to question that mission and point out its incomplete nature. Ultimately, however, the fault for the lapse in the planning must lie with Rumsfeld, the man in charge. In either case, it is difficult to overstate what a key misstep this lack of strategic direction was. Probably the single most significant miscalculation of the entire effort. In war, strategy is the searchlight that illuminates the way ahead. In its absence, the U.S. military would fight hard and well, but blindly, and the noble sacrifices of soldiers would be undercut by the lack of thoughtful leadership at the top that soberly assessed the realities of the situation and constructed a response. The invasion's most memorable image was the fall of the statue of Saddam Hussein in a square in downtown Baghdad on April 9. The few days that followed were as good as it got, the high watermark of the invasion, observed Rick Atkinson, the military historian who embedded with the 101st Airborne Division during the 2003 invasion. This moment also brought one of the highest points in George W. Bush's popularity as president. The first big jump in his poll numbers came after 9/11, when his approval level shot from 55% to a stratospheric 92%. That slowly settled back down into the high 50s, but spiked back up to 77% with the fall of Baghdad. Yet even as the enemy capital fell, there was a quiet chorus of concern, especially from seasoned army officers. "The hard part is yet to come," retired Colonel Johnny Brooks, an old infantryman, warned on the day Baghdad fell. "We can easily win the fight, but lose the peace." The United States needed to move quickly to restore electricity and other basic services. "If we do not give the people positive signals, and soon, that Iraq is getting better rapidly and that they have hope, Then the gunmen will start appearing and taking shots at U.S. military. Then the suicide bombers will appear. Intelligence officials also were sending up rockets of warning. It is premature to be doing victory laps, a senior military intelligence expert on the Middle East said at the time. The hard part is going to be occupation. The Israelis won in 6 days, but have been fighting ever since, for 30 years. As U.S. forces triumphed, Iraqis rose up and expressed their hatred for Saddam Hussein's regime in an extraordinary wave of vandalism. Mobs attacked government buildings across the country, carting off not just valuables but everything that could be pried off walls and floors. During this period, it wasn't uncommon to see a pickup truck carrying doors, window frames, and piping from government offices. "Stuff happens," Defense Secretary Rumsfeld exclaimed at a Pentagon briefing on April 11, 2003, when asked about the looting. "But in terms of what's going on in that country, it is a fundamental misunderstanding to see those images over and over and over again of some boy walking out with a vase and say, 'Oh my goodness, you didn't have a plan.' That's nonsense. They know what they're doing, and they're doing a terrific job. And it's untidy, and freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things. They're also free to live their lives and do wonderful things, and that's what's going to happen here." But that's not the way the looting felt to many of those on the ground in Iraq. During this period, the U.S. military was perceptibly losing its recent gains. It gave the sense that it really didn't know what to do next, and was waiting to pass the mission to someone else. A finite supply of goodwill toward the Americans evaporated with the passing of each anarchic day, Lieutenant Nathaniel Fick, an elite force recon marine officer, wrote of being in Baghdad during this time. "There wasn't any plan," recalled a special operations officer who was in Baghdad at the time. "Everyone was just kind of waiting around. Everybody thought they'd be going home soon." Looking back on that period, he recalled it as the slow loss of momentum. It wasn't like all hell broke loose, it was more like the situation eroded. The message sent to Iraqis was far more troubling than Americans understood. It was that the U.S. government didn't care, or even more troubling for the future security of Iraq, that it did care, but was incapable of acting effectively. In either event, the U.S. government response to the looting undercut the beginning of the U.S. occupation. In late April, U.S. commanders were growing concerned about activity in Fallujah and Ramadi, two conservative Sunni towns an hour to the west of Baghdad, on the western fringe of the land between the rivers. The area generally had been neglected in the war planning, which had focused on Baghdad. The only attention paid to Al-Anbar province was an effort to stop Scud launches against Israel from the remote western part of the province. The rest of it, far closer to Baghdad and able to influence events in the capital, seems to have been ignored. This is inexplicable, even for a war plan built around the narrow aim of knocking off Saddam Hussein's regime, because Fallujah was home to an estimated 40,000 former Ba'athist Party operatives, intelligence officials, and Iraqi army officers who should have been expected to defend their interests vigorously. Central Command's planning for the post-war period, never good, was particularly inaccurate in predicting the likely state of the Sunni heartland north and northwest of Baghdad. Continued armed opposition to coalition forces unlikely once Saddam flees or is captured, killed, stated a classified Central Command briefing on Phase 4 issues. The briefing notes attached in the PowerPoint are even more optimistic. Reporting indicates a growing sense of fatalism and accepting their fate among Sunnis. There may be a small group of diehard supporters that is willing to rally in the regime's heartland near Tikrit, but they won't last long without support. This part of the Sunni triangle was never assessed properly in the plan, Major General Charles Swanick, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, recalled later in an email. On April 27 in Ramadi, Swanick recalled a hand grenade was thrown from a crowd at 82nd Airborne soldiers, severely wounding two. The next day there was an incident in which a number of Iraqis, between 6 and 17, were shot dead by U.S. troops. The event did much to poison relations in the town, ultimately leading the following year to two major battles there in which thousands of fighters died and well over 100,000 civilians were displaced. The facts of the April 28th incident are in dispute, as is often the case with such situations. Army officers from three different units offered different accounts, and an investigation by Human Rights Watch found discrepancies not only among the U.S. military accounts, but also among the versions offered by different Iraqis. The most likely explanation of what happened is that Iraqi provocateurs took advantage of the demonstrations to shoot at U.S. troops and trick them into firing into the crowds. As Swanick recalled it, on April 28, part of the division was based in a school in downtown Fallujah. The 82nd had been operating in Fallujah for 5 days. The Americans thought their presence was reassuring. "We came in to show presence, just so the average citizen would feel safe," Colonel Arnold Bray, commander of the 82nd Brigade in the area, told Human Rights Watch. But the people of the city, known for their cultural conservatism and a xenophobia considered intense even by other Iraqis, found the patrols unsettling and an insult to their personal dignity, perhaps the core value of Iraqi culture. April 28 was also the birthday of Saddam Hussein, and so a natural day for his loyalists to reassert themselves. "Several Iraqis instigated a crowd and approached this school," Swanick wrote. He continued, "5-6 instigators from within the crowd and on the roof of an adjacent building fired AK-47s at our soldiers within the school grounds. Our troopers returned very accurate and precise fires, killing, wounding these 5-6 instigators. The crowd withdrew with the killed and wounded. AK-47 shell casings were found on the adjacent rooftop and from within the area where the crowd stood. A check of hospitals and morgue produced only these 6 killed, as I remember." The leader of the platoon of Charlie Company that was responsible for security in the school when the demonstration began, Second Lieutenant Wesley Davidson, said, "The bullets started coming at us, shooting over our heads, breaking windows. It was coming from the street, the guys behind the taxi cab, and some in the street." Some Iraqi demonstrators told Human Rights Watch that people not near the school were firing rifles in the air, and they claimed that the demonstrators had no weapons. "They suddenly started shooting at us," said Fala Noir Dahir, whose brother was killed. Others said that there was no firing at all until the American soldiers opened up. "There was no shooting, and they suddenly started shooting at us," said Mutaz Fad al-Dulami. The Americans said that 6 Iraqis died that day. The director of Fallujah's hospital, Dr. Ahmad Ghanim al-Ali, told Human Rights Watch that 13 people were killed at the scene and 75 were wounded, with 4 of those dying in the following days. As with many such incidents, the differing accounts remain irreconcilable. The 82nd, said Lieutenant Colonel David Poirier, had the itchy trigger finger. Poirier was about to lead an MP battalion into Fallujah a few days later, in early May, when he was taken aside by Colonel David Teeples, the commander of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, to whom he temporarily reported. "Let me just pass on to you what happened when we did a RIP, relief in place, with 2nd Brigade, 82nd Airborne," Teeples began, Poirier later recalled. Teeples had been in Fallujah because the 3rd ACR was temporarily taking control of the city from Colonel Bray's brigade. He said he was standing alongside Bray on the roof of a building in downtown Fallujah on April 30, watching a convoy of Bray's troops begin moving west to east on Highway 10, the main road, when the convoy encountered about 100 demonstrators in front of a government building. "The lead vehicle fires a warning shot to get them out of the way," Teeples later recounted to Poirier. "A gunner in one of the rear vehicles puts his head down and opens up with a 50 cal, just opens up and lays down 7 people." Teeples was very clear, Poirier said in an interview, that it was unaimed fire, and some innocent people died. Teeples declined to be interviewed for this audiobook, but Lieutenant Colonel Tobin Green, a 3rd ACR officer who was standing next to him atop the Ba'ath Party headquarters building, said the convoy was attacked by the demonstrators. "Eyewitness soldiers from the 82nd come under attack from Iraqis, throwing rocks and bricks at exposed men with complete force at distances of no less than 3 feet. The column came under fire from enemy riflemen on the edge of the crowd," he said by email. Another 3rd ACR officer, who was an eyewitness that day, came down between Swanwick's and Poirier's accounts. The demonstration was approximately 200 persons. Some shots were fired from AK-47 assault rifles from the rear of the demonstration. Generally, these shots were not aimed. Sometimes they were. The Humvee gunner from their D Company, anti-tank company, did fire a burst of 50 cal. The Iraqi who was killed I remember the most was an elderly man who took a 50 cal round to the head at short range. Given that I was not in that soldier's position, I cannot say he made a bad call. The Fallujah hospital director told Human Rights Watch that 3 people were killed that day and 16 wounded. Bray argued credibly that his unit behaved well and honorably in both incidents. The key to the events in Fallujah, Bray said, isn't the behavior of his soldiers, but the malignant character of some people in the town. By April 25, the sole policeman there who had been helping U.S. troops operate a checkpoint was shot in front of his house, and the word traitor was written on his forehead. There was something evil in that town, Bray recalled. In his view, Human Rights Watch overestimated the casualties in the first incident because it collected statistics that reflected violence all the way from Ramadi to Baghdad for a 3-day period. As for the criticism by fellow American soldiers, he said it came from units fresh to Iraq and unfamiliar with the situation. Dave Teeples doesn't quite understand what's happening that day in Fallujah. This is the first fight for him and his guys. I tell him, the war's not over. Earlier that day, he had seen a 3rd ACR soldier standing on a balcony in Fallujah without any body armor on. I told him, son, you don't know where you are. The incidents of April 28th